This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is Charles Chicha with today's reading from Outside Magazine. We have a brand new issue with Outside. This is the March-April 2024 edition, and there are some wonderful tips and articles for 2024 as you get into the warmer weather. So this is Outside Magazine, and our first article is Let's Texas. Three ways coastal Texas will amaze you. Discover the region's wildlife and water sports. The world's largest barrier island, estuaries teeming with migratory birds, kayaking and surfing and kiteboarding and fishing. Want equal doses of nature in action? You'll find it all on the Texas Gulf Coast. Water sports. With 3,300 miles of shoreline, coastal Texas serves up endless water adventures. At Mustang Island State Park, explore intricate marshes on more than 20 miles of scenic paddling trails. Or hop aboard a larger vessel to experience Corpus Christi Bay from farther offshore. Take a sailing lesson or relax on a guided sailboat tour. Ready to amp it up? Kiteboarding can't be beat for a water-based rush. South Padre Island is renowned for its ideal conditions for the sport, with consistent winds and waves year-round. For surfing, head to breaks near Corpus Christi and Galveston. Beaches. Relax at Texas Gulf Coast's many beaches. At Padre Island National Seashore, enjoy the longest stretch of undeveloped barrier island in the world, with 60 miles of pristine shoreline. For more action, stay on South Padre Island with easy access to beach activities including parasailing, horseback riding, and oceanside dining. Traveling with kids, East Beach on Galveston Island is known for its annual sandcastle competition, which features more than 60 larger-than-life sand sculptures. Or try Corpus Christi Beach, located near urban amenities, including the Texas State Aquarium. Wildlife. Millions of migratory birds fly over coastal Texas each spring and fall. Spot endangered whooping cranes in the Arkansas National Wildlife Refuge from November to March. In summer, look for roseate spoonbills with their distinctive pink plumage and the striking reddish egrets. Keep an eye out for juvenile Atlantic green sea turtles, which shelter in the marshy estuaries. Anglers are also in luck. Fishing charters run year-round from just about every port along the coast. Plan your trip during the fall redfish migration, when school of Gulf's most famous species move inshore to spawn and feed. Travel Texas works to promote Texas as a premier travel destination in domestic and international markets. For more information, visit TravelTexas.com. Here are the dispatches called Reading Between the Lines. Let There Be Light by Alex Hurd, X at Alex Hurd. Last year, when it was reported that quarterback Aaron Rodgers had taken part in something called a darkness retreat, staying in an enclosed space, cut off from all light for intense sessions that can last days, I figured we had to send somebody to try this in pursuit of a new and challenging form of adventure. As I soon learned, senior editor Allison Osius had already been pitched about the subject by outside correspondent Tim Neville, an Oregon-based travel writer with deep roots at this magazine and a well-earned reputation for a willingness to try anything, as you'll see in The Darkness That Blew My Mind, which is on page 82, and we will get to that. Even he was not prepared for what it was like. Neville came to Outside in January 2000 as an intern reporting for duty from a small town on Maryland's eastern shore. Growing up, he was the kind of kid who dreamed of seeing the world, which he's certainly done. The freelance career that began here has taken him to 90 countries. He speaks three languages and can get by in a couple more. None of that helped much when the lights went out. Being cut off from light in this way, it turns out, is harrowing, mind-bending, and even life-changing. I've always felt that travel is more of an internal journey than anything, Neville says, and this really hammered that home. People recoil in horror when I tell them about it. I understand the fear, but also now wonder about what else I've been afraid to do. Blair Braverman, an outside contributor editor, also got her start here, though in her case, she is always freelance for us from afar, as part of a career mix that keeps her very busy. She's an author, 3 books with more coming, outside online columnist. She's been handing out dating and relationship advice and tough love for the past 7 years, and professional musher who, with her husband, Quince Mountain, trained sled dogs in northern Wisconsin. Partly because of Braverman's wide image, and also because her life centers on teams of beautiful and athletic dogs, she has a large following on X, formerly Twitter, where more than 125,000 people keep up with her exploits. I'm one of them. And it was on social media many years ago that I first heard about the subject of Braverman's story for this issue. Blowhole, a lively black and white Alaskan husky who famously chewed on the brake lines of her truck after a race they were both in, called the Kubik 440. As you'll see in her piece, "Is This the Face of a Guilty Dog?" page 28, not everybody thinks he committed this toothy crime. I'm recusing myself from judgment. I'm just glad they're both still out there, running strong. Riding high. Last spring, Jared Soares spent several days photographing members of the Richmond Cycling Corps, a youth outreach program for middle and high schoolers living in the predominantly black housing projects of Virginia's capital city, the Kids from Cool Lane, page 70. The assignment was a natural fit for the photojournalist who is based in Washington, D.C. I grew up playing soccer, so I feel I can relate to athletes, Soares says. In a lot of my work, I use sports as a way to talk about social issues. For more than a decade, the RCC has used mountain biking as a tool to connect with students whose communities have been devastated by racist housing policies. While the nonprofit isn't a be-all and end-all solution to systemic poverty, Soares' photos show how such organizations can really touch young people's everyday lives. I wanted to show the joy these kids get from riding around with their friends, he says. Break with reality. In July of last year, 3 decomposing bodies were found near a remote campsite in Gunnison, Colorado. Authorities identified them as Rebecca Vance, her younger sister Christine Vance, and Rebecca's son, Off-Grid, page 96. The story immediately caught the attention of Ted Conover, whose book Cheapland, Colorado explores the motivations of people who abandon mainstream society to rough it out in the wild. Conover's reporting revealed that before setting off for the mountains in 2022, Rebecca had become convinced that COVID-19 pandemic was deliberately engineered as part of a plan for world domination. She thought her family needed to escape something horrible that doesn't actually exist, Conover says. Tragically caught in this web of delusion was Rebecca's 13-year-old son, Talon, who trusted the woman he lovingly called Mommy and Auntie to take care of him. Talon's name was not published in news reports out of respect for his privacy as a minor, but his father told Conover that he felt his son's memory was being erased. According to Conover, Talon's dad wanted the world to know about this kid. By telling readers about him, I felt I could add a dimension to the story that hadn't come out before. So we will get to these articles as we get deeper into Outside Magazine. This next one is an advertisement for Outside Festival, which is June 1st through 2nd, 2024. This is over at the Civic Center Park, Denver, Colorado. And it's the outsidefestival.com. So you can actually get tickets to this festival. Here's a little bit about it. Play, learn, dance, repeat. If we could put together a dream gathering for our readers, what would it look like? This was the big question we asked ourselves a couple of years ago. Now, we're thrilled to announce the answer, the Outside Festival. On June 1st and 2nd, we're hosting this one-of-a-kind event at Denver's Civic Center Park. There will be incredible live music, gripping adventure films, provocative speakers, outdoor sports competitions and skills clinics, and the latest gear. We can't wait for it to start, and we hope We really hope you'll join us. Our main stage performers will include Fleet Foxes, Thundercat, Lettuce, Andrew Bird, Say She She, and The Heavy Heavy. The festival's Film and Ideas Summit will feature exceptional documentaries and conversations with elite athletes, thought leaders, and inspiring activists. We'll also have a gear expo, as well as climbing walls and interactive demos that will inspire you to engage with the outdoors in new ways. Put all that together and you have a gathering sure to get you into a summer groove. Learn more about what we're planning and purchase your tickets at theoutsidefestival.com. Don't miss the 2023 Ironman World Championship documentary streaming on Outside Watch. Last year, for the first time in the triathlon's 45-year history, the Ironman World Championship was split between two locations, with the men in Nice, France, and the women in Kona, Hawaii. To capture the action from all angles, the Ironman group's film crews used 12 handheld cameras, 2 underwater cameras, and 2 helicopters. Their efforts culminated in this year's nearly 3-hour documentary special. For all the best coverage of the world's top endurance athletes braving the grueling 140.6-mile race, tune into the action on Outside Watch. Here are a couple of book reviews, briefly, from our contributors. Captain James Cook is revered as one of the greatest explorers of all time. He's also been widely criticized for his mistreatment of indigenous people and his role in British colonialism during his 18th century voyages. Hampton Sides' new book, The Wide, Wide Sea, out April 9 from Doubleday, $35, recounts Cook's last voyage to the Pacific, where he was killed by naive Hawaiians after an escalating series of miscues and cultural misunderstandings. With gripping prose, Sides details Cook's increasingly erratic behavior as he explored vast swaths of the Pacific and scrambled to find the fabled Northwest Passage along the ice-choked coast of Alaska. His account lays bare the age of exploration's moral perils, which continue to reverberate today. For years, elite ultra-runner Katie Arnold dabbled in Zen, a school of Buddhism that emphasizes meditation and mindfulness. But she didn't fully embrace the practice until a rafting accident shattered her leg, plunging both her running career and her marriage into chaos. In her upcoming memoir, Brief Flashings in the Phenomenal World, out April 16 from Parallax Press, $19, Arnold recounts the story of how a spiritual awakening helped her heal. The Humble Bicycle is for anyone who can ride. From newspaper carriers to food delivery workers to amateur triathletes and professional mountain bikers. A new book by renowned cycling journalist Peter Flax, Live to Ride, out March 19 from Artisan, $30, is an ode to one of civilization's greatest inventions. Flax celebrates the ways riders around the world are connected through a desire for adventure and access to nature. Full of stunning photography and illustrations, Live to Ride is an inclusive vision of all the cycling world is and could be. And here's an advertisement for Jackson Hole. The Mountain of Youth, Bill Briggs, 91 Years Wild. Jackson Hole, Stay Wild. Discover how this local legend, skiing pioneer, and musician stays young by staying wild. Visit jacksonhole.com. Playing music keeps me young, and that's a quote by Bill Briggs. Dispatches, The Approach. Magnificent Obsession. More than 15 years ago, inspired by my father's rich and ghostly memories of the Colorado River and its tributaries, I set out to photograph every mile of it, capturing its beauty and multiplying challenges, and underscoring why its preservation is essential to us all. Story and photographs by Pete McBride. On a warm April morning, I gaze at a ghost tree towering above me. Its leafless canopy seems to be staring up as well, in similar disbelief at the 500-foot-high sandstone cliff surrounding us. There's a cluster of 70-foot-tall cottonwoods. On this river-bottom spot, dead for decades, yet seemingly frozen between the worlds of the living and the dead. Their trunks are black and encrusted with white sediment, but somehow this ancient desert forest is still standing, like a phantom reminder of what we've lost. The base of the tree trunk is swallowed by oozing, fine-graining silt that matches the palette of the walls. This cliffed cathedral is hidden inside a drainage arm of the Escalante River, which flows south into Glen Canyon, and for much of my life until recently, the grove at its base was underwater, submerged beneath what used to be a northern reach of Lake Powell, the second largest reservoir in the United States. As of November, Lake Powell was 37% full, unnervingly dry, but significantly up from its record 22% low in spring 2023. What amazes me most is that I'm walking in roughly the same path that my father, John McBride, did more than 50 years ago. I'm sure about my location because I've studied the old Super 8 footage he shot with his Beaulieu in 1968. The soundless clips show my father and a few pals joyfully exploring the same side canyon, which is at nearly the exact same level it is now. This was a few months before it was all drowned and 3 years before I was born. They wanted to see what nature photographer Elliot Porter called the place no one knew before it completely vanished. Of course, indigenous people had lived through this region for centuries and knew these labyrinths intimately, but few non-natives, relative newcomers, did. And so during America's dam building era, when the Bureau of Reclamation put nearly every western river in its sights, the government flooded Glen Canyon behind the 710-foot high wall known as Glen Canyon Dam. Little thought was given to what might happen to the river and its hydrologic cycles, habitat, and archaeological wonders. Seeing the same trees my father did is weirdly sad and joyous. Lines of cement-colored silt and sediment, known as the bathtub ring, marked the walls around me. On the canyon floor, partially buried recreation detritus, beer cans, golf balls, lawn chairs, even a sunken jet ski, add to the time capsule experience. Len Nesifer, a friend, documentary filmmaker, and a member of the Navajo Nation, is with me today. He walks over and casually says, "Wild, the canyon is returning. Nature bats last." "I guess so," I say, "especially when you're playing with deep geologic time." I've known this river my entire life. I grew up near its headwaters, and learned to swim in alpine lakes and tributaries fed by Rocky Mountain snowmelt. I think about what my father saw more than half a century ago. These days, his memories of that adventure are murky, but his grainy and old footage is profoundly revealing. It shows these same trees thriving with grassy meadows around them. Indigenous structures are perched on cliffs, and lush springs create dancing waterfalls that spill into green alcoves. He and his friends appear equally vibrant, running, laughing, jumping. My dad looks tan and strong, his mood carefree. It's as if the Colorado and my father loosely reflect each other. Back then, they were both wilder. Today, both have been slowed. I've known this river my entire life. I grew up near its headwaters and learned to swim in alpine lakes and tributaries fed by Rocky Mountain snowmelt. And I spent a lot of time with my father looking at it. When I was a kid, we had a family cabin in the town of Silt, which is nestled beside the river between Glenwood Springs and Rifle. I loved fishing from the Colorado's banks and canoeing its whiskey-colored flows, marveling at the quiet power hidden beneath the surface's lazy appearance. Later, I would hone my swimming skills in those sneaky, fast waters. After working in the hot western Colorado sun with my brother, loading hay by hand, we would jump in to wash the dust off. No matter how hard we stroked and kicked, we got flushed hundreds of yards downstream. It was my father who sparked my years-long project to photograph the Colorado from its start near the Central Rockies to its delta terminus just shy of the Gulf of California. After I spent a decade working as an adventure photojournalist around the world, I craved a story closer to home. In 2007, I returned to the high country ranch we moved in to in the early 1980s near the town of Basalt, Colorado. By then, my dad, a lifelong pilot, had figured out how to take off and land using our hayfield as his strip. He invited me to go on a flight, ostensibly to look for cows hiding in brushy backcountry. But once we took off, his voice came through loud on my headset. "Why don't you go on a project here?" he asked out of the blue. "From the air, you can see how damn dry it's getting everywhere. Do a project on water." As he banked the plane, I looked at him, shrugging with my eyes. But he was right. It was time I focused on our backyard. Initially, I think my father pitched the idea to see his son more. But he'd also noticed, like many, that the snowpack above our land was changing, accumulating less and melting faster. The runoff flowed more unpredictably, lurching between droughts and flash floods, the watershed trending drier. In the spring of 2008, I began following our irrigation supply as it returned to the creek, then to the Colorado, and I recruited the best aerial photographic platform I could afford, my dad and his single-engine Cessna 180. We struck a deal. I reimbursed him for fuel and maintenance while he donated his time and bush pilot skills. Taking off from his bumpy grass strip at 7,900 feet, we flew over the Colorado River watershed, focusing mostly on the upper basin, seeking images that caught the eye and documented drought, drying, and change. In the headwaters, we sometimes clawed our way 3 miles above sea level and gazed down on snow-shrouded 14,000-foot peaks where creeks are born. During a flight in late 2012, barely an inch of snow covered the hills, making even famous crests like the Maroon Bells, a pair of postcard-worthy 14ers near Aspen, look naked and thirsty. On a few calm mornings, we flew low and slow, chasing the river. Between getting bucked by wind shear and fleeing bumpy cumulus clouds, we saw clearly how a single mighty ribbon of life, the Colorado, could provide so much for so many. In western cities like Phoenix, Denver, and Las Vegas, the Colorado provides 40 to 90% or more of the water that pours out of residents' faucets. In all, it supplies drinking water to 40 million people in the Southwest. On paper, at least 22 of the 30 federally recognized tribes in the Colorado River Basin hold rights to over 25% of the river. Much of those rights remain untapped. The biggest straw sucking water out of the river, agriculture. There are more than 4 million acres of irrigated farmland in the Colorado River watershed, producing as much as 90% of America's vegetables and greens during the winter months. The river's impact is astonishing. In 2012, its economic activity contributed $1.4 trillion to the Colorado Basin region, equivalent to approximately 1/12 of the GDP, a share that has likely remained the same across just 6 states and 7 California counties. From the air, you can clearly see the web of tributaries feeding one another and the main river stem. Even clearer are the dams, diversions and growing subdivisions, changing the landscape and shrinking not just reservoirs, but the river itself. We are now in our third decade of drought, and climate experts say the situation can no longer be considered temporary. Either way, the West is the driest it has been in 1,200 years, judging by tree ring patterns. With each project that pulls me downstream or upstream, I spread the word that the Colorado and its fin, feathered, and clawed friends deserve water as much as our faraway spigots do. After seeing so much, especially from my father's aerial vantage, one lesson has become glaringly obvious. When we ask too much of a limited resource, it disappears. During a journey in December 2008 with writer Jonathan Waterman, almost entirely on foot, to what remained of the river's once glorious estuary, we trudged the now dry and cracked delta from the U.S.-Mexico border to the sea, a 90-mile slog that nearly broke my back. It definitely broke my spirit. I had never realized the scars we left on this river, even in my own lifetime, until I saw it run dry before my eyes. The river ended in a frothy, flotsam-filled Frappuccino pit littered with plastic bottles. I was floored. But a few years after that thirsty hike with Waterman, I found hope not far from the same spot. Thanks to the hard, quiet work of a handful of conservationists, a pulse flow of roughly 105,000 acre-feet of water, just under 1% of the river's annual throughput, was released into the delta in 2014 to help restore habitat and mimic historic floods. A few fellow river lovers and I paddled that 8-week flow to the Gulf of California as the river restored pockets of the delta. Little did I know that we'd be the last souls to paddle the Colorado all the way to the sea. Rowan Jacobson wrote a classic outside story about it, which ran in the magazine as "The River Was Everywhere and Nowhere." In 2021 and 2022, smaller pulse flows brought pockets of the delta back to life, and with the help of irrigation canals, connected it to the sea once more. Today, several restoration sites serve as small reminders of what the delta once was and could be in the future. After my delta forays, the river called again. Over the course of 14 months with my friend Kevin Fedarko, a writer who loves the Colorado as much as I do, I scratched through the entire length of the Grand Canyon, a 750-mile tip-to-tail trek between river and rim on foot. We wore through 8 pairs of shoes and struggled with navigation, thirst, hunger, illness, injury, and fatigue as we pondered the marvel of that outdoor geological classroom and the river that carved it. We also became acutely aware of the value of water. Every day as we made miles, 15 on average, we searched for springs, rain potholes, and seeps to collect at least a gallon each for survival. Since then, I am consistently marvel at the fact that, according to the EPA, the average American household uses 300 gallons of water per day. Some Western cities, like Denver and Las Vegas, have bolstered conservation by creating initiatives such as doing away with front lawns, recycling gray water, and generally raising awareness. Between 2002 and 2021, Southern Nevada cut Colorado River water usage by 26%, even as the area's population grew. Denver Water claims that, on average, single-family residential customers use as little as 50 gallons per person per day. Of all my river adventures, few compare with the time I shared with my wingman, which allowed us to connect as friends rather than just father and son. These days, my dad's memory of those flights is blurring. The claws of aging have started to dig. When I reflect on the Colorado River and our efforts to document it together, what hits hardest is just how short a society's collective memory can be, not just with politics and conflict, but with natural resources like water. We take both it and our time on Earth for granted. Last year was the hottest in recorded history, but when we get one slightly above average Rocky Mountain snowpack, as we did in the winter of 22-23, much is forgotten. When I reflect further on recent river history and my father's life with it, I find haunting similarities. We have dammed, diverted, drained, over-engineered, over-allocated, and overwhelmed the Colorado, hobbling one of the greatest rivers in the world, all during his 86 years. As my father moves into the winter of his life, we seem to have forced the Colorado River to the same stage. Charles Chicha signing off. We will return next week with more reading from Outside Magazine. Have a great week, everyone.